Hello, witches and listeners. Thank you for joining the podcast for Witchery in the Moon. Witchery in the Moon provides a safe haven for all people under the moon. Everyone is welcome. There is no room in our sacred circle for ageism, sexism, racism, fascism, xenophobia, homophobia, or transphobia. I'd like to welcome you to please join our sacred circle as we discuss tarot, witchery, the moon, magic, myth, and folklore with your host, Devi, and a series of special guests. Thank you for listening and stay sacred. You can sign up now for any of my private or group workshops. Book a tarot reading with me or join my Patreon coven. Link is in the show notes. Stay sacred. Hello, witches. I'm back after a long break during the summer months. I needed some time to recharge my battery and get my energy levels back up. So it makes sense that my first episode upon my return is about crystal energy and the power and magic of Avalon. I'm honored to introduce to you Bev Dodds of Primal Stone. She is an incredible human being connected to Source and a well of information about Reiki and crystal healing. You are going to love her, so let's get into it. I just wanted to leave a quick trigger warning. Bev and I talk about stillbirth, so please be warned of this sensitive topic. And thank you again, Bev, for sharing this intimate moment with us. Hello, listeners. Welcome, and thank you for joining us today on the Witchery in the Moon podcast. My guest today is Bev of Primal Stone. I discovered Bev through my mate, Tommy Vowles, who was the guest actually in my last podcast. He had taken a Reiki course with her and raved about it. So I was interested in further developing my spiritual practice and had always had an interest in Reiki. So naturally, I contacted Bev. Not only is she a Reiki master, she is an expert in crystal healing and magic. So without further ado, I would like to welcome Bev. So welcome, and thank you for joining me today. I look forward to digging deep into the topic of crystals, healing, and Reiki with you.
Oh, you know, thank you so much for inviting me. I'm so honored. I love watching your work, and, you know, I'm just really happy that I get a chance to come on your podcast, which is absolutely brilliant. And thank you very much for a lovely introduction.
You're welcome. I mean, I also enjoy your content. I'm always oogling over all of the crystals and things that you have up. So we've kind of started talking a little bit about what you do, but can you tell us in your own words a little bit more, maybe about yourself and what you do?
Yeah, so I, as you've already mentioned, I'm a crystal practitioner that I got my certification through the hibiscus moon method, which I actually adore and love. And I'm also, as you also mentioned, a Reiki master. But I really started kind of getting into this type of practice in terms of crystals when I actually started wanting to sell crystals. And so I've been selling crystals now, and, you know, originally I did them in pop-up stalls, you know, at holistic fairs and things like that. And then I started, obviously, with the pandemic, and then I went online and started doing like live crystal sales. But it was kind of really early on that I really got into the ethical side of crystals, because it really started my, you know, when you start buying crystals, you start learning where they come from, how they're mined, how they're sourced. And I was really becoming quite uncomfortable about how a lot of crystals were sourced, especially citrine, you know, because I really like citrine.
Okay.
And citrine is one of the most problematic crystals. So, you know, that was definitely kind of where I started to focus my attention in the beginning. But before that, you know, I was a hairdresser for 20 years, you know, so I've always kind of been involved in like holistic-y type of practices.
Right.
But yeah, so that's me.
Thank you for that. Yeah, I have a question a little bit further down here about ethically sourcing and this kind of thing, so we can get into that. But I know that this is like a huge, huge topic. So it's really nice that you feel this responsibility to pay attention to that and to make sure that the crystals you bring to people aren't just quality, but that they're being sourced ethically. And a lot of people, I think, are sensitive to this right now. So then, when and how did your fascination with crystals begin?
I think what happened really was I've been going to Glastonbury for years and years and years, and there was always like very holistic shops and there's lots of crystals and things like that. And I never really kind of resonated with them really at that point. And you know, I just maybe had a couple of tumbles and things like that. And then there was a massive shift in my life. And I really started to seek alternative means in order to navigate, you know, this experience that I was having that was quite a traumatic experience. And that's when I really started to discover crystals, crystal healing, you know, meditation, alternative ways of actually, as I said, navigating that experience. So, you know, and then I really got into it when I really wanted to change the job that I was in. So, you know, I was working in, you know, I went from being a hairdresser. I had this quite traumatic thing that happened to me, and then I you know, I changed my whole life. I ended up going back to university and things like that, and I ended up getting an office job. And going from quite a creative industry to an office environment, it was quite a big change and a shift, and I actually realized this is not what I want to do. And it was a very toxic environment, and I really weighed heavy in on crystals then at that point, and they really kind of helped me, give me a bit of focus, you know, and encourage them into parts of my holistic practice. And then I started considering, right, this is where I want to go. And that really kind of helped me to look into myself to figure out what it is that I wanted to do. Crystals really gave me the clarity. And then obviously I started like, well, it's crystals that I want to do. And then I started that way, really.
It always, oftentimes it's like a shift. You just realize it's like, okay, something in my life isn't right. This isn't what I want. How can I change this? And how can I get there? And what kind of tools are going to help me get there? I totally understand that.
Because the major shift that I actually had was I had a baby who passed away when he was 24 weeks. I was 24 weeks pregnant. And you know, it was the most life-changing thing ever. But at the same time, you know, ironically, in some ways, it really did save my life. And you know, that experience and the things that happened to me during that, I've never felt such one divine intervention. I really felt a divine intervention at a couple of incidents during that experience. And also it gave me so much clarity about, like, I became quite present aware in the trauma of it all. And I became quite empowered. Don't get me wrong, after, like, when it first happened, all these things, I was like, you're quite shocked at yourself of how much you can kind of deal with, if you like. And I always remember having that moment of being quite, you know, this is my body, this is happening to me right now, and I need to do it in a way that suits myself and my baby. Even though my baby had passed away at that point, I wanted to everything to be in a particular way, not in a controlling way, but to empower myself. And this is where I felt like the definitely this divine intervention kind of gave me strength that I didn't even know that I had. And once that kind of happened, obviously I had the grief and things like that, and it was those moments that I, you know, like, I had a lot of clarity, but at the same time I had a lot of grief. And it was using holistic practices that enabled me to have what I would consider, you know, a proper grieving process, you know. So, and as I say, you know, without that incident, I don't really think that I'd been pushed on the path that I'm going on to. And I'm not saying that, oh, I should have had it was supposed to happen. I'm not a big believer of, oh, that should have happened to you. You know, it's not. It's just that I've been able to look at it with a bit more clarity, and it pushed me in a particular direction. Because I think as well, when I the reason one of the reasons I say that I kind of think it saved my life in that terms is because I have personal depression with my first baby, and which is Megan, who's what, 24 now. And that was the hardest thing I've had to say that I ever went through, because of the anxiety and things like that. And I was dipping in and out, you know, of the holistic practice of crystals and going to Glastonbury. And that's where I found Glastonbury, really. And the, you know, the goddess work that I do, which you know about. But I still had this anxiety and this fear underneath the underbelly. And that's what I mean by when Charlie passed away, it really kind of, if I can, it was like, it was almost like, if I can get through this, I can get through anything. And it's literally become my mantra, if you like. And it really empowered me to kind of decide what it is that I want to do and where I want it to go. Even though I've made a few mistakes, hence going into the office, which was definitely not for me. I'm too much of a creator, really. Yeah. It was too stifling. But it really kind of helped me focus about, like, constantly making self-inquiry, develop myself spiritually. And, you know, because as I know, like, it's a constant self-inquiry. No matter, you never get to a point, even though I'm called a master, you never really get to a point whereby, you know, you're completely finished, or what I call completely cooked. It's an ongoing thing, isn't it? It's an ongoing process. And that's what I think these types of practices that we both do makes it more magical, because it really gives us the tools to really get down to that, you know, spiritual inquiry.
Yeah. And Bev, first, I'm pretty sure that I didn't know that you'd lost a child. So first of all, I'm very sorry to hear that.
Yeah.
But I think, as you said, it seems like instead of letting this stop you from growing and developing, you used it sort of as a catalyst to continue to grow, to evolve, to take it and turn it into something like a positive transformation, which I think is really amazing and incredible. And I think it takes a lot of strength, especially in that moment when that's happening. So I think that's really amazing.
Thank you very much. And I mean, I think I'm kind of quite comfortable about speaking about it as well. I'm kind of mindful, obviously, to speak about it in front of other people in case people get uncomfortable, because it is a hard topic. But I also think at the same time, it's something that I think that we do need to speak about a bit more, because, you know, obviously I've got two beautiful, healthy, beautiful daughters, both Megan and Alice. Yeah. And then obviously my little boy passed away. You know, and it's as a feminine or as a parent, you know, it kind of gives each child transforms you in such a way, you know, even though the outcome obviously with Charlie wasn't how it's supposed to be planned. Regardless of each child, of what happens, there's definitely a transformation of each one. You know, it's not necessarily just about the physical birth of a child either. You know, when a child comes into your life, however that means it comes to you, it's a very transformative. I can't say the word properly.
You got it. What transformative. I mean. Yes.
That'll be my dyslexia coming out.
You got it. Yeah. No, I think it is. I think it is. And when we can take these experiences and develop ourselves further, but then also when it offers to us, when we start really thinking, because for me, coming back to my practice, there was also something traumatic that had happened to me, which left me reeling. And I realized that I didn't like the person that I was. I didn't like my behavior. I wanted to change it. And when I threw myself back into my practice, this completely, I was kind of obsessed by it, but it was good because it gave me something positive to focus on.
Yeah.
To not escape from what had happened, because I needed to deal with it, but it was a way for me to kind of parallel these anxieties with something that I was really passionate about.
Yeah, and I think it's really important that you mentioned that, actually. You know, you say that, because it was never like my transformation and my journey, my navigating the experience, it was never about suppressing it. It was never like, you know, I'm fine, it's okay. Don't get me wrong, you do have those moments, you know, you think you try to work through it, but ultimately it's like trying to recognize that, you know, yes, this is grief, or this thing that's traumatic that's happened to me, there's nothing I can do, I can't change it, but what can I do to empower myself, or to let it move on and move it into a place where it no longer has a hold over you or shapes your decisions.
Exactly. So I was just gazing over my questions and seeing if there's something that could kind of
because this topic, what we're talking about, if it could lead into one of my other questions, but what I could do is bounce down to Reiki, because Reiki is a skill that you have, that you teach people, that you do daily. Yeah. And, yes. you know, it changed my life taking the course with you mm-hmm. and having this extra addition for something. So maybe you want to talk a little bit about what Reiki means to you and what it's done yeah. for you.
Yeah, so Reiki has given me so much joy. And I think, you know, even like talking about it just kind of makes me smile. And the major thing that I really like about it is, you know, there is no like dogma or necessarily any rules as per se. You can definitely make the energy and the practice your yeah. own. And that's what I really love about it. But I just feel like when I do magic, I literally feel I have magic in my hands. I feel connected to, you know, higher source. I feel connected to energy in general, and you know, it really helps me. As I say, I do it daily. I do a couple of practices, like most people, you know, when you come to holistic practices or these types of explorations, you tend to mix it up with a lots of different things, don't you? You know, so for me, you know, the first thing I do is, you know, I talk to everybody about the energetic hygiene, wipe down, and I turn it on, and then I protect myself, and then I turn my Reiki on, if you like, and then I go yeah. into doing something like dance meditation, goddess work, and tarot, and crystals as well. But when I first got into Reiki, I was a little bit resistant, which is so ironic. And I talk about this a little bit about on the course, because yeah. there are moments when like the powers that be, like the divine intervention, will step in and be like, it's almost like I've been being pushed to this. The journey is like, it's been slowly poking me in this certain direction. Yeah. And the friends I used to do joint work with, you know, with crystal practitioner, you know, being a crystal practitioner and a sound practitioner, she was like, come on, Bev, let's go and do our Reiki one. And I was like, oh, I don't know anything about Reiki. I don't know. And she's like, come on. And I was just kind of like going with the flow at that point. I said, okay, let's yeah. just do it. And I just remember just that first level, I was like, oh my words. I came out like this powerhouse of like, I just felt like the energy. And it was just kind of just gave me this sense of real connection to source energy. Yeah. And, you know, and the ladies that actually attuned me, a lady called Gina and Gail, absolutely brilliant. They're in their 70s now, and they got attuned back in the 80s. Okay. And so for me, Reiki is like my foundation. That's what I do first. That's what I think about. And Reiki is so magic because you can literally think it on. You can, you know, as we know, intention setting really matters when it comes to Reiki or energy work, you know, and that's what I really like. It's quite free, and it's a very much you can really work your and like expression, you know, use your personality and your expression to do Reiki in your way. So for instance, like I said, you know, I'll get up and I'll do dance meditations well after I've turned on the Reiki, and I'm dancing in my Reiki, you know, and that's what I really like about it, because it's devoid of any dogmatic there's yes. no religion. And, you know, because I've done history, you know, as you know, I did a history degree, and I love history, and I love the history of religion and things like that. But obviously, as we know, there's an awful lot of dogmatic practices yes. and things in that. And so this is why this really resonated really well with me, because it's an energy practice that we can use to raise our vibration, giving us, you know, better overall well-being. But at the yeah. same time, we can really use it as an extension of our personality and who we are. So, yeah, I love it.
I love it too. And I it's interesting how you had this this sort of apprehension at the beginning. I never had this apprehension at the beginning, but since taking it with you, I sometimes have this apprehension, like, is, because, and we've talked about this before, because I know I've written to you before about this, but just this feeling of, I don't feel like something's happening. And then the next time, the next day, it'll be like my hands are on fire.
Yeah.
And then, and so I have these sort of levels and stages of feeling this strong connection. And then when I don't have this connection, I feel sort of like, okay, wait, where did you go? Like, I'm here. I want to do this.
Yeah. And that kind of comes back to the principles, because as you know, there's 5 principles in Reiki, and any of the listeners who don't know, and you know, about the principles, they can just give me a message and I can kind of help them in that sense. But essentially it's about trust. It's about trust in the process, because each day you'll feel a little bit different. Yeah. And also as well, you know, the minute that you say to like, oh, I don't, it's not that, you know, not every day you put it on, you don't, like you said, you don't feel you're tingling your hands all the time. It'll feel different every every single day because you're different every day.
Yes.
But it's just remembering, it's trusting the fact that one, you know it's on, one, you know it's doing and it's going where it's needed, and you just do it. And that's the thing with Reiki. It's about that, you know. I think Dr. Sui literally said the practice is the magic with the with Reiki is the practice of doing it daily.
Yes.
And trust in that process. And sometimes that, you know, that ego will say, you know, your own ego is like, oh, it's not working. Yes. And it's just reminding the ego, it's okay, little, it's okay. It is. Yeah. And just trust in that process, really. Because because obviously I'm a Reiki master and I do treatments as well. And at the beginning, when I first started doing the level two, I definitely had that same feeling of, is this me that I can feel? Or is this to do with the person on the table? Because sometimes when you do Reiki on other people, you have what's called a shared energy connection. And sometimes what happens, because you're connected energetically, you can have the same experience as the person is having on the table. So you can feel what they're feeling, and sometimes you can see what they're seeing as well.
Wow.
So yeah, it is super magic. And so it's remembering, but sometimes you don't. And this is the thing. And so it's when you don't, that's because the part, you know, the Reiki come, I am a channeler of Reiki and it comes through me to that person. And sometimes I can see it and like I said, have a mirrored experience. And sometimes I can't, but that's where I have to go. But I trust the process, and that's the way it is. That person has got exactly what they needed.
Yeah. Okay.
You know, yeah.
Okay. So I have a sort of a weird, it's not a weird question, but it's connected. And of course, whenever I practice Reiki, you come to my mind because you were the one who instructed me and what's attuned. Yeah.
Yes.
So I was on the subway. This was some months ago. I was on the subway and there was a couple sitting across from me and they were holding a dog. And the dog, I think, I don't know, the dog looked sick. They looked upset. They looked like they maybe were taking the dog to the vet or something. Okay. And this poor little dog was just trembling like mad. He would not stop shaking. And now I know that I'm not ready to do Reiki on other people, but I felt so sick for this poor little dog. And so I started to see what I could do.
Yeah.
So I sat there across from it and I just had my hands up, not in a way that, you know, would draw any attention to myself because I didn't want someone to know what I was doing. And it was more just kind of a test for myself to see, can I send my loving, healing energy to this poor little creature who just looks so terrified? And after about 3 or 4 minutes, it completely stopped trembling. It still didn't look well, but it was, you know, it had stopped trembling. It didn't look nervous anymore. And it just sort of sat there.
Yeah.
So my question is, I know that I'm not attuned and I haven't taken the second level to work on people, but how do you feel about working on animals?
Well, animals is a really big thing because animals, they sense energy. And I've been sensing energy, are more attuned to sensing energy than I would say humans. And there's lots of people, like when I teach my level two, I encourage people to do animal Reiki. And I'm also a part of the UK Federation for Reiki practitioners, and they encourage it as well. So absolutely. The only thing, like when you get to level two, it comes always down to consent, because an animal, because there's this question, like, how does an animal consent?
Exactly.
And the main thing that how we speak about that in terms of ethical practices, you know, giving a treatment to an animal, is that you kind of, you turn it on and you let the animal come to you. The animal will respond and let you know whether it wants it or not, and if it doesn't, it'll get up and go, you know. It won't accept and it won't receive that energy. And you know, that's kind of what I really love about, you know, doing Reiki on animals, because most of the time, like, I've got my cat, since I've been doing Reiki, she's like a changed cat. It's really quite funny. Her personality is completely shifted, and when I'm doing it, she kind of just comes in and sits at the bottom of my feet, because she wants to sit in my Reiki bubble and the crystal bubble, and she always lays on my crystals as well. When I'm kind of organizing them, she just lays on them.
Oh, but that's so sweet.
Yeah, but animals, I think it can be a really great thing for animals. Yeah, you know, so I completely encourage Reiki on animals.
Okay. Yeah, I was just curious about this. I had a pug for 15 years and I had to put him to sleep 2 years ago now, or three years ago, because it was just time to go. He just died of old age. But whenever I practice and I cast my circles in my flat, he was always there. Yeah. Always. He would be like, oh, what are you doing? And then he would walk over and then he would sit down and he would stare at me and then he would look at me. And I thought, okay, before I even cast my circle and begin, I would have to drag his bed into the circle because I knew as soon as I started, he's going to want to nestle up in there. And I always thought that that was so sweet.
Yeah. And that, yeah, it is. And that's them showing their consent. They want to get involved and they want to do it, you know. But also, you know, you talk about that, you know, your dog passing away. What's really kind of nice is that, you know, with Reiki, you can send Reiki distantly. Yeah. So when your dog passes away and transitions, you can send it for the moment they transition to have be filled with Reiki love and to feel that energy and that loving energy from yourself, you know, when the dog transitions. And it's trusting that process of Reiki that is what's happening. And, you know, this is where I start to feel it's kind of quite magic. And, you know, when we think about energy work.
Well, you know what I do actually when I call in the ascendant masters, I incorporate two other things when I'm calling them in. I call in my ancestors.
Amazing.
And I call in my past familiars.
Amazing.
So I have everybody with me when I'm calling in everybody. Yeah. And so I try to incorporate and combine the different practices of what I do so that they're all kind of there.
Amazing. That is amazing because energy work really kind of almost comes from the same source, really.
Yeah.
It comes from divine source, and how it gets to us and how we express that depends on what we resonate with, I would say.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think so too. Thank you for that. Thanks for answering. That was a spontaneous question.
Yeah. That's okay.
So the other questions that I have are mostly about crystals. And did talk a little tiny bit already about that you ethically and sustainably source your crystals and minerals, and that this is super important to you and that you pride yourself in this responsibility. So my question is, how do you source your crystals and how do you stay true to ethical sourcing? So I know maybe you don't want to give up all your secrets, but just, you know what I mean?
I'm really passionate about it because when I first started sourcing crystals at first, you know, I was quite not naive. That's not the right. I was just learning an awful lot about crystals and where they come from, how they're made and things like that. And in the beginning, I had a really good wholesaler. Now they sourced ethical and unethical. So they sourced both, but they were really super generous about what was defined as ethical and crystals and things like that. Because in this country, there are really no rules and regulations about what is considered an ethical crystal. And that was kind of like a big thing for me. I was like, what? You know, and especially like when it came to something like the citrine. And as you know, citrine, I really like citrine, but the majority of citrine is either baked quartz or it's taken from practices where children and people who are enslaved in the mining industry are taking out the crystals in order to make extra money. And that's a big thing. It was the idea that we've got, you know, modern day slavery, and crystals were a part of that chain, and it really made me, I was like, I don't want anything to do with that. So it was a case of doing an awful lot of research and really finding out. On the very first guy that I really came across who really helped me loads was a guy called Catcher Stones, and you can go check him out. And he was like the very first person, I would say, in the UK who, you know, did ethical crystals. And so he was really helpful about helping me, you know, source things, because originally I was like, I just want to get stuff in the UK. And it was at that point I couldn't find anybody in the UK that would able to help me, but he helped me in terms of the sourcing crystals outside of the UK. So he was amazing, really.
Great.
And then, you know, while I was buying crystals outside, it was always a case of making sure, right, do they know the mine? Where is it mined from? You know, have they got permission to mine? And, you know, just general, how are they doing this? And I'd like to have close relationships with the miners and the cutters and things like that. And I talk a lot about this on my crystal know-how course. But more and more, I wanted to go more towards and the UK crystals, and it just started to unravel, and I started to find people who were rock hounds in the UK, and I was just like, oh my word, because I could go visit them, I could go and see what they were doing, I could find out their permit. It was just so much easier to be able to get, even though you can get ethical crystals outside the UK, it's just really difficult. You've always got to watch the country situation, because it changes all the time. So like for Brazil, for instance, Brazil was kind of quite a good place to source crystals from at that point, what I was getting anyway, because they had to be licensed and they had to show that it didn't have children in the mines, and it was intended to be families. But then there was a new government, and now they're trying to knock down the Amazon to mine more, because it's not just about mining crystals. It's because crystals tend to be like a byproduct of mining, you know, for your phones and your technology and things like that. So there's a massive push. So for me, it's like, well, my crystals are in a way still forcing that mining, having a contribution to the mining practices. So as I say, I've started to focus more in the UK. And as I say, these rock hounds, you know, I've got one guy who's been doing it for years. He's like 80 now and he still does it. He literally hand mines all of his. So it's all his collection.
Wow.
And he, yeah. And he also buys old collectors' collections, which I think is really magic. So one of the crystals that I've currently just put on my stories was mined in the 1800s, and it's got the names of the people who mined them. So I love that idea. But then there's small artisan miners who go into, they don't use dynamite, they only use top surface collecting. Okay. And for me, that is the Mother Earth is churning up rock and stone and crystals to the top surface.
Yeah.
So for me, that is a more ethical and more sustainable way of mining crystals, because they're coming up through Mother Earth, if you like.
Yes.
And then the ones that where they go into the mine, they're already in mines that are already that were open, but they're now closed. They're not used for, you know, mineral source and minerals as such, apart from the crystals. So they literally go in with the hand tools and just take off the top surface within the mine, if that makes sense. But as I say, they have to, I get to know them. You know, I spend a lot of time having teas and coffees and chatting to them on WhatsApp, sending voice notes, and they're always sending me pictures. That's fantastic. One guy who sends pictures all the time. Look, I found this there, I found that. It's amazing. So, you know, so it's, for me, it's really important, because as a holistic practitioner, where crystals kind of come from and how the mind really matters, because I feel like crystals are our energy practice as well. And for me, it taints the whole process.
Yes.
But, you know, even though I do concentrate in the UK, I still am mindful of outside of the UK, and I'm a part of two different projects to make sure that I still are contributing to try and end slavery in particular within the mining industry. Because it's not necessarily so just about the crystals, it's about your tech as well.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah. And that's a lot of information that I think a lot of people don't really know. They just see shiny, pretty rocks in a store and they buy them, but not really taking it back all the way to source and find and having all of that information. So I know what's going on, but the way that you just described it, I think is really useful for any listeners that don't really know the process.
Yeah, and it's the same with the cutters as well. So we really don't really speak about cutting as well, because a lot of the time, the cutting of minerals, of crystals, you know, so say for potentially India, they'll find a lot of rose quartz. Somebody will buy the rose quartz in its raw state, then ship it to China, and China will then polish it. And then they'll get shipped again all back over to America, like to the Tucson show, if you like. So there's like a massive environmental issue there in terms of carbon footprint there. But then the practices of actually cutting the crystals are potentially problematic as well, because we're not really 100% sure. Like, I've seen quite a few videos of people in China cutting like giant spheres, and you know, they're certainly not in a safe situation where they're mining. You know, they haven't got the right clothing on, they're on unlevel grounds, and any second these spheres can come off and kill a person. Do you know what I mean? So there's all of these types of other considerations. This is why I really stick to raw now for me, because there are some amazing cutters, though. I've got to say, there's some amazing cutters in Madagascar and there's some amazing cutters in India. And when I was buying polished crystals, I used to get it from one factory through my wholesalers, and obviously he had a close relationship with them. He bought and all the equipment, so it was safe and things like that. And obviously I was able to chat to them on the phone and things like this. And their work is amazing. It was, you know, and they do a really good job. So I'm happy for cutting in that sense, but it's another giant issue. And, you know, it gets bigger and it's really difficult to really pinpoint every single crystal that's been polished to know where it's come from, not just from the ground, but who's cutting it. Are they cutting in safe circumstances? Are they getting the value for it? Because this is why, you know, sometimes you see some of these crystals are so beautifully carved and they are done by hand as well. And you think, you know, are they getting the money for it? Is it in a safe environment? And that matters to me, really.
Yeah.
You know,
well, that's really good information.
Yeah. And it's not really to kind of say, oh, just don't stop buying it, because there are some really good practices out there. There are some really good ethical manners. There are some really good cutters. It's just do your research. And if anybody ever wants any advice about how to do some research about it, you know, they can drop me a message.
That's great. Yeah, I'm going to include at the end and in the show notes every way that people can get a hold of you and find out more about what you're doing to get in contact with you. That's great. Thank you. This is super valuable information. I mean, even I didn't really think about the cutting process of it. I didn't even think of that at all. But of course, this is a huge thing. And this, you know, the carbon footprint of things getting shipped here and there and everywhere. And this is, I mean, it's huge. People don't generally think about the bigger picture. I mean, we could even, you know, talked about this a little bit, even with Tommy in the fashion industry, right? In fast fashion, it's it's the same thing. People don't think about the bigger picture. They just see, buy and take home.
But you know, that's not always necessarily the responsibility of the purchaser, though. That's the thing.
Because that's true.
It's kind of, you know, there are some people who can only buy fast fashion.
Because
that's what's accessible, because the pay is low. You know, if people were, in some ways, were able to afford more clothing that were a bit more expensive, they would be able to do that. They'd more likely want to do that, you know, whereas it's a bigger picture, isn't it, really, when we think about the pushing cheaper things. So say, for instance, as a country, and we know China, I don't want to pick on China. It's not that, you know, China's an amazing country, don't get me wrong, but they're able to create things that are a lot cheaper. And obviously countries are sourcing from them cheaper, but at what cost? There was a thing on The Guardian today about Turkey. Turkey are showing pictures on TikTok and they've gone viral because, you know, the way they're working. But they're working in really dangerous situations and there's children in the fields, and that's no judgment on the Turkish people.
No.
But the markets are driving them to do it for cheaper and cheaper and cheaper.
It's capitalism.
And yes, you know, and it's putting people in really bad situations, really. So it's just being mindful of it and doing your research. That's what I think.
Exactly. 100%. So should we get into more crystal information? Maybe. I know you love this topic and I love everything that you're talking about, and I think this is a fun thing for you to talk about. You talk a lot about crystals as record keepers.
So record keepers basically are a triangle. So there's like a tiny triangle in a face, and it tends to be in quartz or a smoky quartz. Okay. And what you do with this, the idea is that you're supposed to, it's kind of like a cut out triangle, a perfect triangle, and they could be facing left, up, right or down. And you basically use your finger and when you meditate with the crystal, and it unlocks the information that's within the crystal. And that's essentially what it is. And they're very rare, basically. So when you get a new crystal, you've really got to inspect your crystals and look at the different formations and the different shapes that are within the crystals. So it just enhances your experience when you're doing your meditation with your crystals. And as I say, it can unlock secret information that's specifically for you, if you like. So it's a different type of formation. It's like you can get a crystal formation that is, has got an Isis face, you know, the goddess Isis. Isis. And when you use face that's got that crystal shape, then that is what you would use for goddess work and encouraging that frequency and that vibration during your practice. So it's a form of formation, if you like. So and you know, and it's kind of the same with starbreeze as well. As you know, I love a starbreeze as well. I always talk about starbreeze, but again, you know, they've got these lines in them that you use to tap into the secret knowledge that was left by the ancient extraterrestrials, if you like, that came to the planet. So yeah, that's what they are. And I noticed as well, you talked about, you know, you was talking about learning as well, you know, the, you feel quite new to crystals in that sense, that you don't really know an awful lot about it, did you say?
No, I've been collecting and using crystals since I'm 16, but I'd never heard this. I'd never heard this thing about record keepers.
Right. Okay.
So that's new for me.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, now I'm going to go through all of my crystals and see what I got.
Yeah. Oh my God. Yeah, you need to have a good look at them, because this is what's the thing is, when I start getting my crystals ready for the live, I literally study them and things pop out at me. I'm like, oh my God, I didn't even realize about that one. And it is so funny. You can spend hours just really figuring out its features and its formations and its inclusions. Amazing.
Yeah.
And that's why I like it natural, because the natural, they've got a story to tell, because a crystal, it takes millions of years to grow in the ground and it's got a story. You know, yeah. They're sitting there vibing, absorbing mm-hmm. the energy and the frequencies of the earth and emitting it at the same time. So when you get a natural crystal, it's got inclusions, it's battered in, it's got markings or chips out of it, it's got a story to tell. Yes. And, you know, we can tap into that by meditating with them.
Yeah. I have polished and raw. I prefer the raw or the natural stones myself because of this exact reason. And
yeah,
there is a place here in Berlin that I do get some crystals from every once in a while. Yeah. But since learning about you and learning about what you do, I pay more attention to where they're coming from. Yeah. But there is something definitely that's more appealing to me. And it's not an aesthetic. I don't look at the stone or look at the crystal and think, oh, I like how that looks. It's more of a feeling. So I look at one and I have this feeling that there's something special about it and that I would need to bring it home with me or whatever.
Yeah. When I teach about crystals in general, even if it looks pretty, I encourage that as well, though, you know, because the eyes are just as much as an intuition thing as much as your gut, because obviously you feel from your gut and you made that decision from your gut, which is just as powerful as the eyes.
Yes.
But sometimes just being pretty, you find out actually that's the one that you need.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah. Why not?
Yeah.
So now people that are either just starting to collect or people that have been collecting for years, I have some really nice books that I often have to go to because there's so much to remember. It's hard for me to memorize all of the properties of a crystal. But do you have maybe a few tips that you would give to somebody who's first starting out with crystals and how can they start?
Well, what I would kind of do is get the crystals together and get your own lookbook and make your own book of their own properties.
Great idea.
The thing is with crystals, so the crystal books are a really good way if you're really struggling and to kind of dip into the books, and there's nothing wrong with them. But the thing is, a lot of the information has actually been taken from earlier sources from back in the 60s up to the 80s of what we called in the 60s, the big six, who sat down. It's a lady called Katharina Raphael. Amazing. So she sat down with a load of crystals with a few of her friends and they meditated with the crystals to get a sense and a feeling of what the crystal felt like. What was its properties? And they've done really good work. And the books, I think she's got about 4 or 5 books out, but it was that process. So she was using those crystals. But really, when we think about a crystal, so let's say a rose quartz from India that was grown in that area, and then a rose quartz from Scotland, are they going to have the same frequencies? They haven't had the same life trajectory. So potentially they've got a different frequency and a vibration. So when you look at a book and you see, oh, a rose quartz is supposed to be this, this, and this, and then you've got your rose quartz and it's not doing it, you think, well, obviously I'm not resonating with that one, when in reality it's got its own little vibe going on. So my top tip really is get your crystals together, get yourself a blank journal, and each week spend time meditating with one crystal and write down, as you're sitting with it, how does it make you feel? What emotion does it bring up? What does it make you think of? Does it feel anything in your body? And you start getting a bit of a picture of what that crystal's mojo is. Okay,
right.
So say like if you've got like a smoky quartz, even though it's supposed to be quite grounded, but it actually gives you a sense of happiness, then you know when you want to raise your vibration in that sense, you would use that one. So once you've done your own little lookbook of your own crystal metaphysical properties, you don't need to do it again because you know what that little vibe is.
And that's great.
And then you can kind of dip into using the other books as a bit of an extension of what your crystals is, see which one it matches more, because potentially somebody who wrote a book about crystal metaphysical properties were using their own crystals. So that's how I tend to do it, rather than learning, because there's like 4,500 crystals in the world.
Yeah.
And obviously I learned this off the lovely Hibiscus Moon, you know, my crystal teacher. And she was like, there's 4,500 crystals and it's going up. how do we learn all of these? And then that idea, they come from different parts of the world.
Yes.
So that's what I would advise anybody starting, is really basically make friends with your crystals and learn their properties.
That's great. No, that's really good. I mean, I think, you know, obviously we can't all collect 4,500 different stones, but, you know, we're obviously drawn to the ones that we're drawn to. When I was younger, I'm like, give me all the amethyst. I wanted all the amethyst. I wanted all the moonstone. I'm obsessed with smoky quartz right now. This is like my thing for like the last couple of years. I'm obsessed with it. Clear quartz, quartz clusters, selenite, celestialite. I'm obsessed with all these things. And I love the idea of a journal, because when I teach people about tarot, it's the same thing. You sit with your cards, you pull out a card, you journal. What do you see on that card? How does that card make you feel? And then you can develop your own relationship with this card. Using a book to read tarot is great, just to kind of get a tiny foundation. But every single deck of tarot is going to have some kind of different symbology and different sort of association attached to it. And you have to attach your experience also to that to make your own thing. So that totally makes sense with crystals, and I love it.
Yeah. So I would totally advise that. And it is just really good fun as well to really get to know your mates, because that's how they become in the end. Some books will say you shouldn't have this, this, and this, or you shouldn't do this, or you should do that. And I kind of just want to say, well, you know, is that what the crystal's saying? I think it's really kind of, you know, these beings have been in the ground for millions of years, and for us to propose our ideas, I don't really think it resonates with me, for me. Whereas I think it's the other way. We really need to listen to what the energy of the crystal is saying to us.
Yes, I totally agree with you.
Yeah.
So Bev, I have two more questions.
Yes.
One of them's super easy. I'll leave that to the end though. But the other one was, we've had a few conversations now, and I know that, you know, we are both big lovers of Glastonbury, Avalon. Yeah. And I think that the listeners will also be interested in this. And I think, if I think about it, I thought that I was there about 8 years ago, but now I'm wondering if it's been even longer than that. But anyways, I just remember when I went there, I was moved to tears. There was so much tranquility. I went to the tour, I went to the chalice well, and I wanted this whole experience that when I was there, I'm like, I want to see the mists. I want to see everything. And I will tell you, the day that I was there, it was horrible. It was so miserable, raining, foggy. So I got my Mists of Avalon moment, and I was wandering, I don't know, there was like a pathway that was sort of like an archway of trees. And as I was coming through, there was a gap in this archway. And then I saw the tour and I lost it. The tears came rolling down my face. And I thought, okay, how do I get to this? I had a little further to walk. And then I finally got to the hill and I started taking the path up. Yeah. And so, I mean, I went to the Abbey, of course, as well. But this was such a magical moment for me, that really shifted something in me about how I view things on a spiritual level. How is it for you? Because I know you really love it there too.
Yeah, so for me, the main thing that kind of drew me to Glastonbury was actually after I had my first daughter. I remember I said I had postnatal depression. I had this sense of me that I needed to find something. It was this pull. And I'd obviously read The Mists of Avalon, and I've got friends, the lovely Moira and Astrid when I was down south, and they've been so influential on me, and they introduced me to The Mists of Avalon. I just couldn't find me groundness. I couldn't find it. And that's where I kind of went, right, that's it, I'm going to Glastonbury. And I don't know why, there was no reason apart from me that I haven't read the book. And when I got there, it was the most magic thing I'd ever experienced. So I got out of the car and I remember going, I could just breathe. I could breathe. And I felt it was so busy, but it was quiet and serene. And I it was really the first time that I felt, one, myself, two, I was grounded, and I really felt that I could breathe, that I wasn't losing my mind. Because obviously when you're not well like that, you really feel like consumed by it. And anyway, so that was really the first moment. And then obviously I've been going all the time, but what I found is, you know, there's been different magic moments that happen, even at some of our darkest moments, really magical things have happened, because I got married there and everything.
And then
I had a proper handfast there. I stayed at the St. Michael's you know, the lodge that's there, and I ended up meditating over a 2,000-year-old chalice that wow. It's believed to be the chalice, but who knows, you know. So there's lots of different moments, but what I've really found really magical about the place is when you need Glastonbury energetically and you need that vibration, that frequency for healing, you absolutely feel her. You feel the energy and you find this discovery, and you meet really magic people, or you meet unusual people, and it's always very much synchronicity about Glastonbury. But when your cup's sort of filled, you don't feel her. You definitely don't feel her. I remember going there thinking, I can't feel it. I can't feel that magic. Okay. What's going on? I can have the moments. And then it twigged, and it's because I had to give back. So I continue to go down there with that idea in mind. So sometimes I go there to fill myself up, to feel grounded, and take my daughters there, because I wanted the daughters to find a place, a spiritual home, where when I'm gone, which obviously, you know, the circle of life, it will happen. I want them to have a place in terms of expressing their spirituality. And they really both do resonate and connect with it. But as I say, I do give it back when I go there. I leave offerings, I leave my energy, and I give my energy. And I also set up crystal grids to connect to the energy of the Chalice Well and Glastonbury, with the focus of either I need help and support or giving back. There's been like loads of incidents, just meeting just very random people, and just obviously come from all over the world to go. But because I buried Charlie there, who my son who died. I was very fortunate, because that's what I mean. It's kind of like the whole cycle of life that I find myself at that place attached to it. But I scattered his ashes in the orchards. But the thing is, they don't allow it to happen anymore. So I was fortunate enough when I first went there, because I just knew that was another moment. It's like, I've got to go to Glastonbury. That's where I'm going to lay him to rest anyway. I went there, and the woman who ran it at the time, she had the most amazing blue eyes. I remember just her eyes. And she was like, is this what you want to do? She went, amazing. And she was saying, he's in really good company. Lots of people from all over the world come here to meditate and also have had their ashes spread up there. Wow. So straight away, I felt like this amazing connection with the, you know, and obviously I scattered his ashes. So for me, it's like, it was almost like giving them back to the womb of the land, if that makes sense. Yeah. And that was such a magic moment for me, because as you know, the Chalice Well is, you know, it gives off iron water, and which tastes like blood, and the ancients believed it was the womb of the land. Yes. And that was how I really magically connected, because obviously I was in quite a dark time because he'd passed away, but that really showed it. Really, I had this resonance to put him back, and it felt so right. And those are the types of things that always happen there. It kind of just unravels. And like this woman, I could still see her piercing blue eyes now. Amazing.
Yeah.
And as I say, there's been like lots of adventures then, because when I got married there, I actually got married to my children's father. It's not, obviously you all know John, don't you?
Yes.
But it was my children's father, and we had a hand fast there. I never planned to have a wedding in Glastonbury. It just unfolded. It was so magic.
That's amazing.
Because obviously I like my history, and I knew about the Roman side of the wedding rituals and the hand fast side of the wedding rituals. Then we had the procession through the Glastonbury Abbey, got married and blessed at the well, and then went to the head of the well. You know, all these things kind of just unfolded. And, you know, I mean, obviously I'm not with my previous husband. It just, you know, sometimes things happen, don't they? And, you know, nothing, nobody's fault. It just ended type of thing. But even like taking John down to Glastonbury, he was kind of, he did find the magic. He finds it kind of quite funny, like, as well.
That's so nice, though. That's so good. And it's nice that you can share your experiences and create new experiences with him there as well. When I was there, it was very quiet. There wasn't a lot of people, which I kind of liked, but I remember taking my shoes off and dipping my toes into, there was like a little stream nearby. And just connecting to the ground and being with my bare feet in this park and just really feeling it.
Yeah.
You know, despite the fact that it was pouring cats and dogs, I still had such a, my chest felt open. It's hard to explain this, but I just felt like something opened in my chest, and I, it was extremely emotional for me, and I'll never forget that moment.
And that's it with Glastonbury. It definitely has, depending on what's going on in your life, it really, really presents itself when you need it, you know. And I mean, do you ever find yourself at the White Well at all? Have you been to the White Well?
I don't think so.
Right. So, well, the White Well is right next door to the Chalice Well. It's kind of, for me, the energy of the Chalice Well is very calming, very healing, quite serene, very much high priestess. Then on the other side, right over the road, is the White Well, which is the primeval, naughty, if you like, passionate well. And it's in the cave, because that's what's kind of quite magic as well about the water that comes out of the Tor. It's got two caverns, one that's calcium based and one that's iron based.
Oh.
And the calcium is the White Well, and it's looked after by volunteers, but people go swimming in there.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's in this cave. It's got all offerings to the goddess. It's really very different vibe from the Chalice.
I'm going to have to go back then, and I'm going to have to find that, because that sounds really incredible. But I remember seeing this iron trickling stream, and I remember thinking, oh, wow, this is so, I'd never seen anything like that.
Yeah. But was that actually in the Chalice Well?
That was above it, like this sort of,
I know.
If I remember it correctly, there's like a tiny bit of like a waterfall, and then the water is running down towards the Chalice Well, and then there's this big open pool at the end, at the base.
Yes. So that is a Vesica Caspiscus. Is that how you say it?
A Caspiscus?
That's one.
Yeah.
So underneath that, there's a crystal grid.
Oh, wow.
There's an act, they buried a crystal grid underneath it. You can find it online. So if anybody, because this is what I tend to do, I've created my own crystal grid to resonate and connect with those crystals. So I use the energy of crystals to really hook up to it. And, you know, I would invite any of your listeners to explore that. And if they really want to tune in to the Chalice Well, then you can definitely use crystal grids to hone in on that as well.
Oh, that is good. I'm definitely going to look into that. Thank you for sharing that. That's amazing. Thanks for sharing all of that information about yourself, your experiences and everything. I think that's really amazing. And anybody who's listening, who has been wanting to visit Glastonbury, hopefully this will give you some more encouragement to get there and visit it, because it's really incredible. It's a very magical place.
Yeah.
So my last question is a very simple one, and it's just, how can the listeners find you?
Yes, so I'm on Instagram as Primal Stone Soul, and that's where you'll see all my posts, and that's where I do my crystal lives at the moment. I'm also at primal-stone.com, and I'm also on Facebook, and it's just Primal Stone Soul on Facebook as well.
Okay, great.
And I also do in-person, and I'm actually based on the Wirral. So if there's anybody locally in the Wirral, and they can do that. But I also do distant healings as well, if people are into giving that a go as well.
Yeah, great.
So I like the idea that time and space doesn't really matter to be able to get these types of practices.
Yeah, that's so good. And in these days and age, especially in COVID time, you know, we have to find ways to make everything work. So that's great.
Yeah.
So I will include all of your links.
Thank you very much.
In the show notes, and any other little notes, I will also leave in the show notes. So if people have questions, they can also write to Bev. You can write to me if you need more information. But yeah, Bev, thank you so much.
I really, really enjoyed this. It's been absolutely brilliant. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. For me, it was such a pleasure, because, you know, I don't think we've actually had a full-on conversation like this in quite some time.
No.
So this was also nice for me to get to know you a little bit better. So thank you for your trust.
No, honestly, thank you. It's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you very much for inviting me on. Honestly, it's been
brilliant.
You're
welcome.
Dear listeners, thank you for joining me today. This podcast would not be possible without your support, so I thank you. Members of my Patreon coven have access to all sorts of magical goodies and assistance throughout the year. You can subscribe for as little as €5 per month. The top tier is the Coven Supreme, priced at €30 per month. You will get sigil magic, tips and tricks, a weekly tarot card, a monthly message from tarot, a 20-minute consultation with me, my 3-card reading called Total Lunar Eclipse, which is valued at €35, access to the online Coven community I have created for all of you lovely witches, as well as an 18% discount off any booking or workshop with me at any time. I look forward to meeting you there. If you have enjoyed what you've heard today and want to help keep me on the air, please take some time to leave 5 stars and a lovely review on Apple Podcasts. Another thing that would be so lovely is if you would share my podcast on social media. All of this will make such a huge difference, and it will help others who need and want this kind of witchy content to find me. Thank you for your constant and loving support. Stay sacred.